Aquaculture and You, Creating a Sustainable Resource. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. What happened to the Great Lakes perch?
So back when I started with Sea Grant, I was the assistant director for research. And one of my first jobs was to help coordinate the pre-proposal process where investigators would put their ideas together in 1 to 2 pages. And I was new and I wanted to make my point, and I got everything set up for the panel and sort of went into the details of each proposal. And we got a stack of probably about 10 to 15 proposals on yellow perch. Now, I grew up in New England when we used to fish the small lakes for pickerel or pike or other types of bigger fish. And if we caught a yellow perch, we would either throw it back or put a bigger hook on it and throw it back down to get the bigger fish. So when I came out to Wisconsin, having grown up on seafood and ocean fish on Friday nights, I see all of these proposals on yellow perch. And in the pre-proposal panel, we brought in some experts from all over the Midwest to help us decide what would be the best proposals. And we got to about the 10th proposal on yellow perch. And finally, I just said, you know, what's the big deal with yellow perch? Everybody's writing proposals on yellow perch. And the whole room just fell silent. And someone just turned to me and said, have you ever heard of the Friday night fish fry? And I guess I found out then how important yellow perch was.
That was Jim Hurley, the director of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant, sharing from personal experience the importance of yellow perch to Wisconsinites. Maine may have its lobster, Louisiana may have crawfish, but in Wisconsin, yellow perch reigns supreme. Found in inland lakes throughout the state and in the Great Lakes as well, you can't have a proper Wisconsin fish fry without perch. Given its prominent place in the state's cuisine, I was quite curious about the history of people's interactions with this fish. It was surprising to learn then that yellow perch was not initially the fish of choice for the Europeans who first settled in the Great Lakes region. Native Americans had, of course, fished the Great Lakes for centuries. Their impact on the Great Lakes fisheries, however, was minimal. As their populations were relatively small, they did not manipulate the environment extensively, and their technology was pre-industrial. Accounts from early French explorers repeatedly expressed amazement at the size and abundance of the fish they saw in the Great Lakes.
In this freshwater sea, there are sturgeon, whitefish, trout, and pike of such a monstrous size that nowhere else are they to be found larger, and threaded with many other species of fish that are unknown to us.
Gabriel Sigard, 1624. The pristine Great Lakes provided a virtual Eden for freshwater fish. Continuously supplied with cool, clear water from numerous tributaries, the lakes were low in nutrients and high in life-supporting dissolved oxygen, what lake scientists define as oligotrophic. The dense forests of the region helped keep the surrounding soil moist and in place, and slowed the winter snowmelt into the tributaries, keeping the rivers brimming well into late spring. Vast wetlands and marshes lined many parts of the Great Lakes coast, most notably around Green Bay and the southern tip of Lake Michigan, the western tip of Lake Superior, and the western reaches of Lake Erie. These wetlands, the rocky reefs in the lakes, and the clean gravel beds of their tributaries offered ideal spawning sites for a great variety of fish. By the time Europeans arrived on the scene about 350 years ago, stable communities of fish occupied almost every ecological niche in the Great Lakes, from the shallow bays and marshes of Lake Erie to the deepest waters of frigid Lake Superior. Lake trout and burbot were the dominant predators, feeding on sculpins in the open water and emerald and spot-tail shiners near the shore. Along with four types of endemic ciscos, or chubs, the lakes held enormous schools of lake herring, lake whitefish, and round whitefish in their deeper waters, while in the shallow bays and nearshore areas, the water teemed with lake sturgeon, northern pike, suckers, channel catfish, white bass, freshwater drum, longjaw cisco, sauger, walleye, and yellow perch. Lake Ontario also had a thriving stock of freshwater Atlantic salmon. It's thought that half of all life in the lakes then consisted of fish weighing more than 10 pounds. All the predator species routinely reached sizes over 20 pounds, and massive lake sturgeon approaching 300 pounds prowled the lake bottoms. During their various spawning periods, these fish would mass together, either close to shore or swimming up the rivers, and it was easy work to catch plentiful amounts of large and tasty fish. Before 1800, the bountiful fisheries of the Great Lakes remained intact. As Europeans began to settle in the area, the same factors of the Industrial Revolution that were detailed in the second podcast, dams, pollution, and the industrialization of fishing technologies, took a drastic toll on the original fish stocks in the lakes. The first commercial fisheries were established in the 1830s and 1840s, and though they took many types of fish, they concentrated on landing the largest and most prized fish, salmon, whitefish, lake trout, and once they determined they could make caviar from their eggs, lake sturgeon. The first to go were the indigenous salmon in Lake Ontario. Particularly vulnerable when they made their upriver spawning runs, which, by all accounts, were as spectacular as the salmon runs in Alaska today, by the late 1850s, the salmon began to disappear. They had been indiscriminately fished, speared, and trapped year-round since the beginning of the century, causing one pioneer, Silas Davis, to later muse on
how unwise the early settlers were in their reckless slaughter of native fish, birds, and beasts.
The first Canadian fish hatcheries, which we also noted in the second podcast, were started by Samuel Wilmot in direct response to the dramatic decline of these Lake Ontario salmon. Another fish culturist we mentioned, Seth Green, turned to fish hatcheries after his first job fishing and selling the native lake salmon played out. Restocking was not able to restore the once plentiful fish, however, and they were completely extinct by the end of the century. Though steamships did not begin arriving on the Great Lakes until 1869, new netting technologies had preceded them, and by the 1870s it was apparent that a seemingly boundless resource was in decline. This was one reason the federal government had created the U.S. Fish Commission in 1871, and Wisconsin created its own fisheries commission 3 years later for the same reason. But as the fish became scarcer, the Great Lakes fishermen tried even harder, using more boats, going further offshore, and working longer hours.
During the year 1875, there has been great complaints of scarcity of fish, and there has been a falling off of at least one-fourth, so that it is evident to all that the waters of Lake Michigan are being gradually depleted of fish.
Wisconsin Fisheries Commission Annual Report, 1875. Whitefish catches dropped abruptly at the end of the 1870s, but the total catch of Great Lakes fish remained stable until 1892 because of increases in the harvest of other species. One of those species was yellow perch.
While the whitefish and the pike have been disappearing, the perch have become enormously more abundant. Before 1882, only a few scattering ones were obtained, averaging about 6 to each lift of the pound net. Since then, they've become more and more numerous each year, until in the spring of 1885, never less than 50 pounds and sometimes as much as a ton of them were taken at a lift.
Green Bay Fishing Survey, 1891. The intensive harvesting of larger predatory fish, combined with the increased nutrients added to the lake waters by sewage and sawmill wastes, created environmental conditions initially more favorable for the yellow perch. This perch population boom made them a target for the commercial fisheries, who had begun pursuing lake trout, sturgeon, and lake herring as well. Unfortunately, this yellow perch fishery was short-lived. By the late 1890s, the commercial perch harvest was already declining, along with those of many other fish, the lone exception being the lake trout. Since then, commercial catches of all the Great Lakes fish have fluctuated widely, but generally have exhibited a downward trend throughout the 20th century. The yellow perch fishery has never returned to the immense levels of the late 1800s. This overfishing of the resource took a terrible toll on lake sturgeon. Sturgeon can live to be well over 100 years old and have a very slow reproductive cycle. Their populations plummeted after 1900 and have never recovered in the Great Lakes. Wisconsin alone has managed to maintain a thriving population of lake sturgeon in the Lake Winnebago watershed, but it took a lot of dedicated fisheries management and citizen participation to achieve this. It's an amazing tale in itself, and if you wish to know more, UW Sea Grant and the Wisconsin Historical Society Press joined forces recently to produce both a text and audio version of People of the Sturgeon, which tells that story in detail. But back to perch. You'll recall that in the 1870s, fishermen were already remarking on the decline in fish. In 1872, the total catch of the U.S. and Canadian fisheries was estimated to be around 39 million pounds. In 1889, the total official catch numbers peaked at over 146 million pounds. From the mid-1880s to the mid-1890s, catches routinely exceeded 120 million pounds of fish each year. And those are the official numbers. Contemporary sources assure us that much of the actual catch went unreported. Even in lakes of enormous size, such astronomical takes from wild-caught stock could not be sustained for long. Ironically, since the commercial fishers turned to fish of lesser value to maintain the catches, the actual value of the harvest to the men doing the work increased very little. The fishermen employed all the latest mechanical developments to aid them in landing fish, with the exception of trawling gear, which became tangled and useless in the Great Lakes due to the rocky lake bottoms. Fish in the Great Lakes underwent the same pressures as ocean fish did in the last 150 years, but with additional complications. Environmental pollutants can concentrate more in the relatively closed system of a lake as opposed to the open sea. And the increasing human populations and industries around the Great Lakes added more and more untreated municipal and industrial waste runoff for the lakes to absorb. The lumber industry was doubly pernicious for the lakes in this case. As the lumber mills dumped sawdust and other materials into the rivers, while the resulting deforestation from clear-cutting lumber around the lakes increased soil erosion and deteriorated the ability of the land itself to supply the lakes with cool, clear water. Parts of the lakes became eutrophic, so full of nutrients that algae began blooming. When such algae starts to decay, it removes oxygen from the water, which can reduce the levels of oxygen below what many lake fish, including yellow perch, can tolerate. A second complicating factor for the Great Lakes was, and continues to be, introduced and invasive species. The four upper lakes had long been closed off from downriver intruders by towering Niagara Falls between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. In 1829, the Welland Ship Canal was built to provide a route around the falls, and other canals between the lakes followed. Species such as the sea lamprey and the alewife were first seen in the upper lakes in the 1800s and exploded in numbers in the mid-20th century. Some species were deliberately placed in the lakes, such as European carp, brown trout, and rainbow trout, by well-meaning fish hatchery enthusiasts in the 1800s. Others have escaped, such as rainbow smelt, which got out of Michigan bait fish holding ponds in the early 1900s. 20,000 humpback salmon were accidentally released into Lake Superior in 1956 and now naturally reproduce in all of the five lakes. Throw in a couple species each of water fleas and gobies, zebra mussels, quagga mussels, white perch, the Chinook and coho salmon still stocked by the American side for sport fishing, and around 150 more non-natives, you have, if not quite a freak show, certainly a Great Lakes ecosystem forever changed by human activity from what it was 200 years ago. Given these stresses, one might predict that crashes would occur in the remaining fish populations during the 20th century. And crash they did. Lake herring and cisco catches began to fall from lake to lake in the 1920s through the 1950s, usually starting with the southernmost lakes and ending with Lake Superior, the most remote northerly lake. Historians think that the commercial fisheries switching to yellow perch in the 1920s and 1930s, the desire of tavern owners to bring people out on a Friday night during Prohibition, and lingering religious traditions about consuming fish on Fridays, all combined to give yellow perch its present pride of place in Wisconsin fish fries.
Can I get you tonight?
Perch.
Okay, I'll get that right in. Okay.
Though Lake Whitefish did begin to make sporadic comebacks in Lake Michigan and Lake Superior in the mid-20th century, it wasn't until sea lampreys were brought under control in the 1970s that their fisheries steadily improved. Meanwhile, the lake trout had been amazingly resistant to intensive fishing for an extremely long period of time. A voracious and independent hunter that will feed on many different types of fish, shore to shore, top to bottom, its non-schooling behavior had saved its numbers in the upper Great Lakes. Eutrophication had made the lower lakes inhospitable for the lake trout by the 1930s, however, and by the 1960s, even the lake trout fishery in Lake Superior finally crashed, probably due to lampreys and overfishing. In 1969, the Cuyahoga River, which flows through Cleveland, Ohio, into Lake Erie, caught fire, and the mass media announced that Lake Erie was dead, choked by algal blooms, fish kills, and toxic industrial waste. The 1960s were probably the lowest point for the health of the Great Lakes. The only fish left for the commercial fisheries were smelt, yellow perch, and bloaters. However, citizens on both sides of the border became concerned about the state of the Great Lakes ecosystem and enacted sweeping reforms to address the situation. Starting in the 1970s, environmental regulations and water quality standards improved the water supply. Sea lamprey were reduced, new, stricter fishing regulations were implemented, and fisheries management began taking an optimum sustainable yield approach to the lake fisheries. Though commercial fishing now employs a tenth of the people it did in 1900 at best, sport fishing has boomed since the 1970s and is now a major economic force in the Great Lakes region. Sport fishermen have a direct interest in keeping the Great Lakes clean and healthy for fish, and their favorite fish to catch by far is yellow perch. In Lake Michigan, the Green Bay yellow perch fishery continued to provide harvests over 1 million pounds a year up to 1964. But that fishery also crashed in the mid-1960s. Another crash in the mid-1990s was so precipitous that Wisconsin banned commercial fishing of yellow perch in 1996. Wisconsinites must be wondering, what happened to our Great Lakes perch? Fred Binkowski led the UW Sea Grant research that investigated this question.
I'm Fred Binkowski. I'm a senior scientist here at the UW-Milwaukee School of Freshwater Sciences. The yellow perch research in the 90s, funded mainly by Sea Grant, was part of a group of Sea Grant-funded projects in Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. So there was probably close to almost $900,000 being dedicated to solving or attempting to solve the decline of the yellow perch population in Lake Michigan, which probably started in the mid-90s. When spawning surveys were done, they would only get large fish. There were no small fish in the survey. And if you're doing a survey, you should typically get a cross-section of all your classes in the survey. But this continued on for several years. Then they also noticed that the female population had declined significantly to the point where it was probably more than an 80% to 20% ratio, 80% males and 20% females. And that was primarily due to the fact that the commercial fishery gear that was being used would target larger fish, and the females typically are larger. So the females were just continually taken out as part of the commercial harvest, which was all legal, but they were being targeted. Then in the mid-90s, we started seeing evidence of the problem with the zebra mussels. The project started, I believe, in 97, and the project ran through 2001. What we found out is we couldn't pin it down to a smoking gun. In other words, if you wanted to blame something or some organism out there or fishing, it didn't get to that point. We never were able to come to that conclusion. It was more likely to be a combination of things that was working against the perch population. As an example, I said the zebra mussel population exploded. They ate up a lot of the phytoplankton, the food that was available for the zooplankton in Lake Michigan that would typically feed on that. And then the zooplankton was the feed for the young perch. So what was probably happening, the young perch were dying of starvation, or because they were so weak and vulnerable, predators were cropping them off. And that's why we saw less and less young fish in these survey studies. The commercial fishery for yellow perch was closed in 1996. And to the best of my knowledge, that may have been the first time that the commercial fishery was ever closed in Lake Michigan.
Has it been reopened?
No, it hasn't been reopened. There's probably been numerous efforts to get it reopened, but there's probably not enough information that the state agency has at this time to be able to justify opening it up to a commercial fishery again. I don't know how much longer it will be closed, but it could be a long time. Green Bay, on the other hand, has always been a pretty stable fishery, well studied. We have over a 30-year data set on the Green Bay perch population. However, in early 2000, there was a sharp decline in the population, so much so that there was a lot of concern that it might even fall apart. But for some strange reason, it rebounded on its own, and I think today the population is doing quite well. During that period when the population was down in Green Bay, I believe they reduced the commercial harvest limit down to as low as 20,000 pounds. And then I think gradually they continued to boost that up, and today it might be up to 100,000 pounds in Wisconsin waters of Green Bay.
But the Green Bay fishery is separate from the Lake Michigan.
Yeah, in terms of how it's managed, yes. But there's obviously overlap. In other words, fish that are caught in Green Bay and tagged, they do move into Lake Michigan. There are perch that are found as far south as Michigan waters off Michigan City, Indiana. So they do move around. We see less and less of them now in Lake Michigan, looking at the tags that are on the fish. When the harvest in Green Bay was over 1 million pounds or more, well, there's just the population was just so large, and it just expanded and went into these other areas to take advantage of spawning habitat, feeding habitat, and food supply for that matter, too.
So where are Wisconsinites getting their yellow perch from for their fish fries now?
Most of the Friday night fish fry yellow perch are coming from Lake Erie. Mainly the Canadians are the primary providers for that, although there is a commercial fishery on the U.S. side of Lake Erie, too. But Lake Erie is the main one. And then probably after Lake Erie, it's probably a tie between who's in second place, but it could be Lake Winnipeg, it could be Lake Huron, could be Lake Ontario, too. Certainly not Lake Michigan because the commercial fishery is closed, and it's not Lake Superior because that's just not a habitat that's ideally suited for yellow perch.
The U.S. and Canadian catch totals from the Great Lakes in 2009 were around 45 million pounds, less than a third of some of the huge harvests from the 1880s. But perhaps we are finding out what a sustained yield from the Great Lakes can look like. What types of fish will ultimately comprise that catch may well be a question with a continuously evolving answer, as it is certain that with the high volume and global reach of human trade, new invasive species will appear in the Great Lakes despite the best precautionary measures. But will people in Wisconsin have to continue to buy their beloved yellow perch from Lake Erie in Canada, or catch it themselves from an inland lake or on a Great Lakes sport cruise? In response to this dilemma, some aquaculturists are working to provide a new source for Wisconsin's favorite, yellow perch. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, 2012. Thanks for listening.